Support for The World comes from HintWater, makers of fruit-infused water with no sweeteners or calories. Hint's 25 flavors include blackberry, lemon, and new clementine water. In stores or at drinkhint.com. Hint, water with a touch of true fruit flavor.
Hello, I'm Alana Gordon. I'm a reporter and producer at The World covering global health. Here at The World, we've been holding a weekly series of coronavirus conversations presented jointly with The Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health, taking your questions to the experts. This discussion series is featured on our Facebook page, but we wanted to share with you what we think are really valuable conversations here in The World's podcast feed. This last week, we checked in with Dr. Caroline Buckey about what's next in the coronavirus pandemic. Buckey is Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Associate Director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. Caroline, to begin, more than 2 million Americans have now tested positive for COVID-19 that have been reported. More than 100,000 people have died. Cases have dropped in some states, like here in Massachusetts, but others like Florida and Texas are recording steep increases. And this is all while 50 states are taking steps to reopen. It's a confusing picture, to say the least. And so, in your view, where are we at this moment?
So one of the reasons that we're seeing this confusing picture around the US and around the world is that, you know, there's been a staggered epidemic that has taken off in some places and has come under control and is just starting to take off in other parts of the country and other parts of the globe. So whereas the early epidemics in New York and Seattle and Massachusetts spread very quickly in the earlier months of the year, we're now seeing the virus really taking hold in Arizona, Texas, Florida, and they are now going through their major first wave. So although as a country, we've seen kind of a flattening off of cases and now a resurgence, that really reflects the spatial spread of the virus from the epicenters at the beginning of the year now to these new hubs in the south, southwest, and southeast of the country.
What do you mean by first wave when you think of this?
So in fact, wave is something of a misnomer because it implies that in between waves, you would get a trough where there are a few peaks, and that's not what's happened here. In some places, we've seen local reduction of cases to very low incidence, but in as a nation, we're still very much in the first surge of this outbreak. And so, you know, the extent to which we can call them waves or whether it's just ongoing transmission is sort of an academic issue at this point.
One of the things as we think about reopenings has to do with indicators of how, where communities are at in these different moments of surges and having things under control. How do you measure that and know?
So, of course, from the beginning of the outbreak, there have been calls for testing, adequate testing. And in that context, finding new cases, we're talking about viral testing using PCR. And that remains the mainstay of case counting around the world in this country as well. And that's the main criteria by which we're assessing where we are with the epidemic. But of course, because both who gets a test and what testing capacity there is very variable and continues to be under capacity in many areas, that's not really an adequate representation of where we are with the epidemic because we're missing a lot of cases, either because they're not getting tested because they're mild or asymptomatic, or because there's not sufficient testing capacity even for people with symptoms. And so so there are other indicators that we should be using to try to get a handle on what's going on. Hospitalizations and deaths are more reliable than testing, but of course they're lagged by a couple of weeks at least with respect to the actual infection itself when it occurred. And so we need to start thinking about other proxies for transmission, and that could be things like mobility data, so how people are moving around and things like that. But really what we want to have as an indicator is something as close to the point of infection as possible and as closely representative of transmission in the community as possible. So that's a hard problem, given that the testing capacity right now is still not really sufficient to do that kind of real-time analysis.
I want to kind of do a check, because we spoke a few months ago, and one of the things you talked about at that time was the importance of understanding how prevalent, how many people had been infected in the community already. And you were talking about a huge need for being able to test that. Where are we at now with that? And because part of that was being able to then inform these kind of policies of how and when and where to ease restrictions in a way that keeps the outbreak under control.
Right. So we were talking about antibody testing. So rather than testing for virus, what you can do is look for previous exposure through looking for an immune response to the virus. And those are called seroSURVEYs or seroprevalence surveys. And the reason that those are important is because they give you an idea of the cumulative burden of the disease overall. So who are all the people that have already had this thing? And those are very important. One of the issues with antibody testing is both how you design and roll out at scale serosurveillance platforms. And in most places, there aren't huge serosurveillance efforts being pushed, at least in the US, but they're still very important. Where they have been done, it shows that there's we're very far from this herd immunity threshold, or this idea that so many people have been infected and are now immune that it's safe to open up and transmission wouldn't be able to take off. It seems clear that we're very far from that, almost everywhere that seroprevalence surveys have been done. I think there are a few caveats there, because the antibody tests themselves are not perfect, and they may have different sensitivity and specificity. So we may not be detecting everybody that is protected against disease or has had the disease in the past, simply because the test is not specific enough. And very recent data shows that T-cell immunity, so there are two arms of the immune system. There's B cells and T cells, and B cells are the ones that produced antibodies. And that's what the serological tests are measuring. They're measuring antibodies. T cells are a different arm of the immune system. And it seems from very preliminary data that the T cell response may be more sensitive as an indicator of previous infection. The other thing to say is that the antibody tests so far have only been validated on symptomatic patients. So if it's the case, which we think it is, that symptomatic patients generate a stronger antibody response, then it could be that the antibody tests are less sensitive in people that have had mild or asymptomatic disease. And that would mean that we would also be missing some fraction of people that have had the infection, but we can't detect their antibodies. So that's all to say that there are some issues with measuring how many people have had the infection. And similarly, we still don't know, since we last is really protective against reinfection. So in terms of, is it safe to reopen? Can we have immunity passports? There's still a lot of work to be done to understand really how protected you are, regardless of which measure of immunity that you use. And again, it's likely from other coronaviruses that there is some measure of protection, but we don't know how strong that's going to be.
When you think about that, was such a big question, and it's still, it sounds like still a question.
Yeah, I think
but
so.
But the T cell thing seems to be a big kind of movement in terms of where the science is going with that.
There's still a lot of unknowns about immunity, I would say.
Yeah. One of the, when you're talking about kind of the space and the time between cases or infections and how that manifests and what you can see based on the tools that you have, is it just, when I think about across the world, whether it's Europe today, where Prime Minister Boris Johnson is talking about this plan now to ease lots of restrictions, or in the US with what we're seeing, whether it's here in Boston or elsewhere, is it just to be expected to expect new upticks in cases and new outbreaks given this climate?
Yeah, I think so. Given that we are far from herd immunity, so we're not going to be protected just because many of us have already had it. So that implies that if you reopen and you increase contact rates between people, inevitably you will see cases to start to rise. And I think that that's to be expected. And the question then becomes a question for policymakers about how much of a rise they're willing to tolerate, and whether they are going to differentiate between rises in ICU bed usage and deaths, and they'll make a decision based on capacity, or whether they want to make their thresholds based on number of cases, the rate of new cases, and the total incidence in the population. So yes, we should expect resurgence when we start to reopen. And indeed, we're seeing resurgence in South Korea and in China. And so we can learn from that I think we will also see resurgence. Or actually in the US, it's not even resurgence, it's just continuing transmission and uptick in cases.
Zeroing in, actually, I'm curious about China. It's actually 6 months ago today that the lockdown was put in place in Wuhan. And since then, China has kind of been viewed as really getting this disease and infectious disease outbreak under control. But now, as you were talking about, there's been a new outbreak, I think about 100 cases in Beijing. So then there's now a reimposing of certain restrictions, less so than the lockdown. But what can you learn from that? Or what can be done differently in the future?
Well, I think it's one striking difference between China and the US, for example, is that there's a strong reaction to relatively few new cases, right? They are in a containment mode where they see a cluster of cases and they react strongly to extinguish them. And that's that flexibility and adaptation to changing transmission is something that I think is very important and will continue to be important. That is in contrast to the US, where we have widespread community transmission, very high incidence in certain parts of the country, and we are very far from containment. We also don't seem to be even considering reversing the policy in terms of the reopening. So I think what we can learn is, going back into lockdown is of course a terrible option. However, we do need to be flexible and we need to be able to respond when cases do occur and clusters start to happen, because we're not close to herd immunity. So, those can build and become a really serious problem. In the case of the US, we have so much ongoing community transmission that these very intensive contact tracing efforts and so on are unlikely to have as much of an effect because we have so much prevalence anyway.
That gets to this question from online, which is that Vice President Mike Pence wrote in the Wall Street Journal that concerns over a second wave are overblown. That the U.S. as a whole is, quote, winning the fight against COVID-19. And one part of this question is, do you think we should be worried about new waves, or waves as we're talking about it with the caveat of how you defined it? And also, are we in a better position to fight the virus today than we were 4 months ago? Which I think about when you're talking about contact tracing and community transmission, but we have contact tracers more so.
Yeah. Are we winning the fight against COVID in this country? I think that's demonstrably false. We're really struggling. And I think if you look at the growth rate in cases in the South and the Southwest, the Southeast, those states are really struggling to control transmission. So do we know more now than we did? I think so. We've had months to do some science. There's been a recent trial of medicine for people who are on ventilators that seems to show some at least reduction in death rates among people who require supplemental oxygen. There has been some progress in trying to move vaccines forward. So in that sense, I think we are in a better position. The management of patients, we know what to expect more. In that sense, we are. However, since the beginning, we've been calling for surveillance, proper surveillance, scaled surveillance, testing, making sure people can get tests, making sure that we understand, we have intelligence around what's happening in our communities. And I still don't think that we have that capacity right now in this country. So when we talk about second waves and is there a risk, I think there's, I wouldn't classify things in waves, but I would say the risks are evident. There are cases spiraling out of control in many parts of this country, and we need to reduce transmission from the first wave in many states. Mm. So yes, I think this is a concern, and I suspect that the winter months will see an increase in the concern as we need to be indoors and we see the reopening of colleges and schools potentially. So I think there's reason to be concerned, and we should be really investing in surveillance and testing and tracing and all those things.
This question is also from online, and I also want to remind people who are tuning in that you can post your questions too to the Facebook Live. So some questions have been raised about whether upticks in confirmed cases are really due to more people getting sick with COVID-19 or just increased testing. What is your take on that, and how do you as a researcher untangle the two?
Yeah, so I think because of this issue with testing capacity, there is always this issue where, increased testing allows us to find more cases, and it potentially allows us to find cases that we wouldn't have if we were only testing people that were hospitalized. So it's true that testing is the way that you find cases. But I think that there's no question that the uptick that we're seeing in many parts of the US is a real epidemiological uptick in the number of cases. And that's a problem. We've also seen the age structure of the cases changing and shifting towards a younger age group. I think it's quite hard to disentangle whether that's who's getting tested, whether it's a true representation of a shift in transmission to the younger age groups, whether it's older people are staying indoors more because they're worried. So it's hard to assign causality to some of the aspects of this, but I think that there's no question that there is a real uptick in cases, and that's not simply a reflection of testing.
This question is also from online. Speaking of the way that you're looking at different like demographic groups that are being infected, like younger people right now, we know that COVID-19 risks is linked not just to how many cases are in an area, risks for the disease itself, but factors like someone's age and overall health. So is there any sort of clear guidance for people in vulnerable groups on how to stay safer as communities reopen?
Yeah, this is really challenging. So age is probably the most important risk factor, but other comorbidities also play a role. And I think for people in high-risk groups, it will be important to be as vigilant as possible about your contacts, who you're mixing with. And if you can work from home and stay home, then you should. And really limit interactions, especially with individuals who you know are either unable to or unwilling to social distance and wear masks and all of those things. And then, you know, the normal precautions need to be taken when you have to do, you know, essential things like go to the grocery store. Masks, social distancing, hand hygiene, those continue to be the best recommendations for people in high-risk groups. And it's a really difficult time.
What do we know about, this is another question, about the role that kids and children play in spreading COVID-19, and how might that inform plans for the next school year, whether it's remote learning, in-person classes, or some kind of hybrid? Because there's a lot of uncertainty right now of what school might look like in the fall.
Yeah, there's some data that suggests that children are both slightly less susceptible, slightly less likely to transmit the virus if they do get it. And we already know that they're much less likely to develop severe disease and to die. So I think there's some indication that children may be less problematic for transmission, but it doesn't seem to be by a huge amount. And I think actually it remains to be seen how much it's going to matter for school openings and transmission. It will be interesting, you know, Southern Hemisphere schools are opening now. And so it will be interesting to see what their experience is with this. And there might be data coming from those households and so on. Hmm.
This question is from the World's Instagram page. Can you speak about the risk of contracting COVID from secondhand smoking? Like if a smoker's in the park a meter or two away as a passive smoker, does that increase COVID risks?
I don't I don't think that there's any data on this that I have seen, but I would say that if you are outside and you are 2 meters away, you know, you're not at a significantly high risk of the virus spreading to you. But again, people should be wearing masks. And if you're smoking, I think you should be staying away from people when you're outside.
This is a question from Lawrence. Based on very spotty use of masks in the US, if a vaccine were to come around, but only a low percentage of people were to get vaccinated, like the flu levels of under 50%, would that be sufficient to quell a second wave of COVID-19 infections?
So it really depends how the vaccine works, what the mechanism of protection is, and whether it does protect. So there was the recent trial, the recent study coming out of Oxford was in macaques, so in monkeys, and they showed no difference in infection and viral shedding in the monkeys that had had the vaccine and had not, but the ones that had received the vaccine didn't get sick. So if we have a vaccine like that, it wouldn't do anything to reduce transmission. It would just stop people from getting sick. If we had a strong vaccine that actually protected against infection, then 50 or 60%, given what we know about transmission, might be sufficient to really limit transmission. But again, you might still get localized outbreaks because that 50, 60% herd immunity number assumes that everybody's mixing together. But in fact, our contact networks are very heterogeneous and some people contact many people and some people contact few. So it's slightly more complicated than that. Again, I think one important thing to mention about the macaque study, and this is based on work from Gabriela Gomez has done for a long time, which is that there may be a strong dose effect. So when you challenge monkeys in these trials, you give them a lot of virus. And it could be that in normal transmission settings among humans, we're not receiving that amount of virus. So we don't, again, it depends on the mechanism by which the vaccine protects and whether it protects against infection or the disease. So it's very hard to say. But I think 50 to 60%, it would still help if it was a completely infection-blocking vaccine.
This is a new question from Alexandra, thinking of the non-vaccine moment that we're in, which is about travel restrictions. And what do you think of the value of having them in place? I mean, obviously in the United States, between states, there aren't restrictions, but in general.
So I think it really depends where you are with local transmission. If you have a significant amount of community transmission, then travel restrictions may not make much sense because the ratio of imported to local infections is not going to change transmission very much. I can understand why people may want to impose travel restrictions when they've reduced cases a significant amount. And, you know, there's discussion of countries having kind of alliances of countries that have controlled the disease, allowing movement between them, but not from hotspots like from the US. And, you know, I can understand why that might make sense for some of those countries. In the US, you know, it seems at least regionally, there's so much transmission going on that international travel restrictions probably don't make sense.
You talked about contact tracing a little bit earlier in our conversation, but this question's come in from online. Are there any real success stories of in the United States when it comes to contact tracing? And what would it take to ramp up contact tracing to where it needs to be? And I know what you mentioned is when you have a lot of community infection, that makes contact tracing super difficult.
Success stories from the US. Well, I know New York City has implemented contact tracing and they're trying to roll it out. I don't know enough to know how well that's going. I would say that it's going to be an important part of the response. It has been in other countries, but really probably it'll have the most impact when we've transmission levels are very low and we're kind of more in a containment phase. I think the digital contact tracing efforts still have a lot of wrinkles to iron out, both in terms of the technology itself and the extent to which it will work to accurately identify contacts, but also all of the issues around privacy and what actions are taken when the data comes in from those apps and whether people will even use them. So I think we have a long way to go to establish really coherent contact tracing strategies for this country.
You're part of a team that uses mobility to understand people's movements during this time. Are you seeing changes in people's movement and behavior with the restrictions easing up? And is it then possible to make links between these movements and communities with infection rates?
Yeah, I think, so actually it started several weeks ago. We started seeing that people were moving around almost at baseline levels, so pretty much close to normal. At least to the extent that we can measure those movements. Of course, behavior may have changed in other ways that we can't measure, like people may be wearing masks or washing their hands more, and we can't measure that. But certainly the mobility data suggests that people are moving around in nearly normal ways, and that, although that's regional, varies by region, and that started several weeks ago, in fact. And so I think it's a good indication it foreshadows the uptick in cases that we're seeing in many parts of the country, for sure. And so it's a useful indicator and it's real time. So that's one of the reasons that we think it's a useful additional data point for policymakers to use. Sorry, it's like a thunderstorm here, so you can hear the rain.
Not really. This is another question from online, I guess less about movements. It's something you mentioned about masks. They've become a sort of culture war flashpoint. What do we know about how effective masks really are? And why do you think they've become this kind of flashpoint?
I have no idea why they've become a flashpoint. I mean, except that anything in a time of crisis can become political. But really, I mean, I think that the consensus is that while it's quite hard to measure the impact of masks just methodologically, there's enough kind of plausible mechanisms by which masks are likely to prevent droplet transmission that it's a sensible policy. And so it makes sense to wear masks and do social distancing, just like it makes sense to wash hands. So, I don't think there's a scientific reason for it to be controversial.
This question kind of goes more global, and you mentioned this with lessons from China at the top of our conversation, but this is from online. Earlier this year, alarms were raised about how COVID-19 could spread across Africa, yet it seems that the reality has not been as bad as many feared, at least not yet. There is an increase in cases in places like South Africa. What do we know about why Africa hasn't been as hard hit as expected? And are there lessons for the rest of the world?
I would say, I mean, this virus has taken a long time to ramp up in many countries, surprisingly long time, I think. And so it remains to be seen how bad the epidemic becomes in Africa. I would say that, you know, for example, countries like Rwanda have done an amazingly strong response and continue to be kind of examples of how you do this well, even with, you know, limited resources. So I think that Africa is a huge continent and different countries are responding differently. One obvious difference is the age structure. So in many low and middle income countries, you just have very much fewer people over the age of 65 or 70. And so it could be that their demographic structure is protecting against the worst of the disease. So that's one explanation. But it's hard to generalize about a whole continent. And I think, we'll have to wait and see. I do think as well that surveillance systems are sometimes preventing us from understanding exactly what's happening. So that's another fact to consider.
We just have a couple minutes left. This question is about from Katie, and then I'll have a few wrap-up questions. How concerned are you about the return to university dorms, such as in a place like Boston has announced? Schools are relying a lot on frequent testing. Is that sufficient?
I'm worried about dorms because that's the perfect environment for the virus to spread. So I think that it's, yes, having frequent testing is a good idea and taking precautions as best we can, but I still think that it's something that we will want to watch very carefully, because we know that that will lead to transmission if a virus does get into a dorm setting.
I just have two more questions really quickly. One is, I just have to ask, as someone doing the work that you do, and as you're talking about this really not being under control in the United States, and with restrictions easing, how would you navigate that in your everyday life, knowing kind of the way and the risks and what's going on and the decisions that you make and going out or not? Yeah.
I think we all have to weigh up the risks to ourselves, to the people in our households that may be at high risk. So thinking about our social networks and evaluating the risks of disease and death among those contacts is important. And then I think that, you know, we have to do our best to remain sensible and wash hands and wear masks and social distance and try to keep contacts to a minimum, and keep an eye on the prevalence in our region as best we can. So not taking stupid risks, certainly not going to crowded places, not going to places indoors, not going to bars, those kinds of things.
I mean, that counters, for example, in places like Boston that are opening restaurants.
Yeah, I won't be going to an indoor restaurant or bar for the foreseeable future.
And then finally, I want to ask, just in this moment, what are you most concerned about right now, as we, whether it's most on your mind today, just kind of as a way to wrap up?
So one thing that I think is really important that is just going to be devastating for research and for our ability to innovate is the announcement about H-1B visas, J-1 visas. And, you know, that is going to affect all of us. I was on a J-1 visa, then an H-1B visa. Many of my colleagues at Harvard and the people in my group are going to be affected. And the reality is, we can't confront these crises of our times, a pandemic like this, we can't confront it without specialist expertise. And if we can't recruit the best scientists from around the world, we can't make any progress. And you know, the kind of innovation and science hub that the US is and could be is going to be majorly hampered by that ruling. So I think that's something that is very worrying to me.
That was Caroline Buckey, Associate Professor of Epidemiology and Associate Director of the Center for Communicable Disease Dynamics at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health. This Q&A was jointly presented by the Forum at Harvard's T.H. Chan School of Public Health and us here at The World. You can find the video of this discussion on our Facebook pages, at Forum HSPH and at PRI The World, and see more from the series at theworld.org/coronavirus-conversations. Thanks for listening. From PRX.